and the antenna is connected to an antenna, a 50 ohm line, and we measure an input of 60 ohms resistive plus J35 reactive. And let's normalize that to 1.2 plus J0.7. So, okay, so we're going to look on now on our Smith chart, and we're going to get down to 1.2 resistance and look along the tangent line, 0.7. Make a dot over there, approximately and as close to that point as possible. Take your compass, and we're going to open the compass with the pin in the center, the 1.0 like we've done in the past. Put the compass on that dot, and we're going to swing a complete 360-degree circle. We're going to mark that dot, and that circle, we'll call it circle A, and the dot A also for simplicity. At this point, the next thing we're going to do is we're going to draw a line now with our straight edge. Put the straight edge on 1.0, put the straight edge, line it with that dot on that circle, and we're going to make a straight line right through the edge of the chart. Anybody have any questions right now?
And when you say extend to, right to the straight edge, you're going to go out to the perimeter of the chart, only on the upper side or both on the upper side and the lower side? Back to you, Mel.
Just on the upper side, just right from 1.0 through that dot, right out, like you say, to the edge of the chart. Is that clear enough? Over.
Clear to me.
Okay. Now I want you to mark that line that's coming through the edge of the chart. Just mark it, start, S-T-A-R-T. And now I want to draw a line, an arrow, going counterclockwise, or to the left of where you're looking at the Smith chart right now. Now, if you'll notice also, because we're going counterclockwise, we're going wavelength towards lows. You'll notice that counterclockwise. And if you look on the chart where this line just went through, you'll see it's approximately at 0.328. Approximately at 0.328. Any questions?
I'll bet you that equals 0.328 lambda relative. That approximately right?
Roger, you got it. Now, our coax cable for this particular demonstration was measured. We don't have to worry so much about the frequency as we're going to take the measurement of it, the physical dimension, length of the cable, and then I reduced it down to modify the mathematics, of course, to take it from length to wavelength, electrical wavelength, and I found that the electrical wavelength of my piece of cable was 0.282 electrical wavelength. Last week I went over the way we convert at a frequency, particular frequency, to electrical wavelength, so I won't repeat that. So the cable, we'll say, is 0.282 electrical wavelength. Now, if you'll notice that on our line that we just drew was at 0.328. Now what we're going to do, we're going to add 0.328 and we're going to add to it this 0.282 wavelength of our cable. And that's going to add up to approximately, well, not exactly, I'm sorry, not approximately, 0.610. Now, if you notice on the chart, it only goes, it doesn't go past 500, 0.500. So what we're going to do to get us back on the chart at this point, let's subtract 500 from 0.610. So we get now equals to 110 wavelengths to load. Any questions about that?
So what I think you've just said is we started at 0.328. We added to it 0.282, making a point sign, 0.610. When we're looking at those degrees, or actually wavelengths, toward load on the outside, it only goes up as 0.5, and then it starts going back down again. So by subtracting 0.5, we know how far we're going to go beyond the point of 0.5. We're going to go 0.11 beyond that point. Is that approximately true, Mel? Go ahead.
Exactly. That's it. So we're going to continue around the chart now, and you'll notice below the axis line, we'll see 0.0110. 0.110. Make sure I said it right. Now, okay. Now, that, leave that point right now. Just make a pencil point there. And now I want to draw a line from 1.0 with our straight edge right through this point of 0.110. We're going to make another straight line right through the periphery line. Any questions?
But let me ask you a question here now, Mel. Depending on which kind of Smith chart you use, some of them start off at 0 on one side, and they crank all the way around to 0.5, and then from 0.5, they start cranking back down again towards 0. We want to go 0.11 beyond the 0.5 point, where it's, in some cases, cranking back down. I guess there are other charts that go beyond the 0.5, but I don't think so. To go 0.11 beyond 0.5 means we're going to be going to 0.390, which is beyond the 0.5, when it starts cranking back down in the same counterclockwise direction. I may have that wrong. Back to you, Mel.
Now, there's a specialized chart for that, Dick. This one where everybody is basically using this one to download the chart, the complete, you know, the Black Magic design. That's why I'm sticking with this particular procedure. I did it on a different chart originally. That's the funny part with the chart, Dick. But I figured I'll stick to this Black Magic design to eliminate confusion over.
Yeah, you may want to repeat to people the website where they can get that to make sure they got the exact same chart in their hand that you're using, Mel. Go ahead.
Yeah, they all got it. Oh, they all said they never knew. Nobody ever knew that this was available. I got so many thank yous for this. You know, a number of people in the profession that didn't know that this was available online. And I have a feeling, I don't know, you know something, like maybe I shouldn't say anything, but I'm surprised they offer it for nothing over.
Yeah, you used to have to buy it from Mrs. Smith. The wife of the man who invented it, but nowadays it's freely given out. You go to a good graphic supply store these days, and you try to buy Polar Graph Paper, you might be able to buy it. You try to buy Spinner's Beautiful, it comes out in color if you got the right kind of printer. So life is good these days. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, K2KY, in fact, if they would have said, you know, they wanted a little donation for downloading it, I would be more than glad to send it to them. Because it's so clean, it's really excellent. All right, continuing. So, all right, we just drew that line at where I marked it end at 0.110. The next thing I do, I measured the load, load at the antenna. In other words, when we made circle A originally, this was at the end of the coax, you'd say, where your radio is in your shack. Now let's go to measure at the antenna. So for this demonstration, I measured at the antenna 32.5 resistive minus J30. Normalizing that, as we've done in the past, dividing by 50, we get 0.65 minus J0.6. Now let's locate that on the chart. And remember, we're going below the axis now, minus. Find that little dot on the chart. Put a dot on there, on the axis, on this point, again, 0.65 minus J, 0.6, put a dot there. Again, take the compass, open the compass up, pin on the center, pencil on the little dot here, and I'm going to swing another complete circle, okay? Any questions? Okay, now, take a straight edge again. Straight edge on 1.0 in the center of the chart. Put the other, line the straight edge with this dot we just made on this, and you made a circle, and where the dot is still, you should be able to still see the dot, I hope, and know where the dot is, that 0.65 minus J0.6, and you're going to make a straight line again, right through the edge of the Smith chart, right up to the edge of the periphery of the Smith chart, and you'll mark this line C. And we'll talk about this in another minute. Now I want you to do, take parallel lines from each end of the circles that cross the axes. Where they cross the axes, I want you to drop parallel lines straight down to that to the scale that's below the Smith chart. You'll have four lines, in other words. So we got two circles, so we got four lines. Any questions? Okay, I'll give you a couple out here on where it says on the left side of the Smith chart where it crosses. You can see we can read the SWR at this point at both the, both ends here at one end of in the shack where we made the measurements on our feed line, and we also can measure it our SWR at the antenna on the left side. Now if we go to the other side, we can read now our loss in dB. You see our loss in dB? We can read that now, and we can see that our loss in dB, comparing the two points, that we can see we got about 1.2 to 1.3 dB loss. Does everybody see that? Okay, that's a simple. Now I'm going to tell you about this line C. You know this line C we drew? If we had made all the measurements had come out both with our instruments correctly, and also if we had measured the electrical length, the length of the wire physically correct, most likely this point where we had point C, line point C, that dot, it most likely would have fallen on that other line where it says end. But because it's so close to that, I can actually say to myself that pretty accurate. It wouldn't make much difference if I, moved everything over that little bit. So in this case, like Dick said in the past, if everything looks, somewhat correct on a Smith chart, you're really, you're in the ballpark. In fact, you're behind home plate, sitting in a very comfortable spot. So see here, it actually more or less confirms that our measurements are fairly close in this case. Go ahead, Dick. You want to make any comments on this? Over.
You did it graphically, and I did it with a set of an equation. At one end of the cable, you told me the impedance was 60 ohms plus J35. At the other end of the cable, you told me the impedance was 32.5 minus J30. I could calculate the reflection coefficient in those two cases. I won't quite tell you how I did it. But in one case, the 60 plus J35, which I believe was at the antenna, we had a reflection coefficient of minus 10.02 dB. At the other end of the cable, most likely inside the shack, we had a reflection coefficient of minus 8.05. The difference between those two happens to be 1.97, let's call it 2 dB. There's 2 dB of difference of reflection coefficient at the antenna versus the shack. Since the transmission line has conveyed the signal up to the antenna and whatever reflected back down toward the shack, that's a reflected signal creating the visoir, the signal has been through the cable twice. And I can see why Mel chose these numbers, very carefully chosen. He's got very, very close to exactly 2 dB of loss for going through the cable twice. I bet you he's going to tell us that the chart tells him by his graphic technique his cable has 1 dB of insertion loss. Let's see if he does say that. Either that or I've made a math error. We'll soon find out. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, exactly. No, it says 1. With this method, of course, when you're drawing it, the pencil thicknesses and all this kind of stuff, and let me put it to you this way. At the shack, it was 60 plus J35. At the antenna, was 32.5 minus J30. Yeah, I doodled around, Dick, until I could come up with some of these things to make it so that it would be very obvious. I don't want to make things close. I wanted to make it so you could actually see it as a thing large. So I more or less expanded on things so that you can actually read off the chart very prominently here that you have approximately 1.37 something or so, if you could read the split somewhere deep approximately.
Yeah, that mic switch of yours gave you a little bit of trouble on that last transmission, Mel. But what you guys are slowly finding out is that a smart engineer, particularly if he's about to commit some money and man hours to a project and making predictions, a smart engineer will solve this problem twice, as Mel is doing it. He'll do it mathematically, as I just did it. And if both answers come out the same, these two entirely different procedures, if they both come out the same, you've quadrupled your confidence that you're on the right track. If you've got a significant difference between the graphic approach and the mathematical approach with your handheld calculator that can handle complex numbers, if you've got a significant difference, then it's time to start figuring out what's really going on before you tell the chief engineer to go do it this way and commit the funds to buying that particular hardware, so to speak. Back to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Exactly. I did it, of course, originally mathematically, and then I wanted to do it, you know, show it to you graphically. And for most amateur radio applications, if they want to, you know, get an insight into transmission line loss, this is a simple graphic method, and the mathematics may be a little bit hairy for them. And, as you know, you work with it constantly, like I have in the past. But if you'll notice, that's why I made it so that where I had the line at the end line at 0.110, and then we drew the second line at C. The spacing between these two shows you what the error factor may be. But for amateur radio, of course, it won't make any great difference. But it gives you great insight. Like Dick said, it's basically, many times, it's great to do it both ways, because if both answers come out extremely close, I will take the mathematical answer as my, as my gospel, because math is seldom wrong. But if the math all of a sudden is way off from what I've drawn here on a chart, you know, I've either made a mistake on the math or I've made a mistake on a chart, which in most cases, the Smith chart, usually you don't make a mistake if you went ahead and you measured and did the simple math of normalizing your measurements. So it's better to do it the other way over.
I see great advantages of doing it each way. And which is your favorite is strictly a function of how you were taught and which technique you eventually decide you like better. Now, what Mel has done to give a very nice demonstration of all the capability of a Smith chart is use it to show you, first of all, how the real input impedance of an antenna becomes something else when it's been through a certain length of transmission line. Second of all, he's calculated what the new impedance is, what it could have been if the line was lossless, what it really was in the real world, and that's a way of figuring out what the insertion loss of your cable is. When a guy wants to only know insertion loss of the cable, usually he'll do it if he's got a VisWarm measuring setup that he has confidence in. He'll do it with a pure short circuit or a pure open circuit at the far end of the cable. If the cable was completely lossless and you put 1 watt down the cable, the signal would go down to the end, hit the short circuit, reflect back, and you would get 1 watt coming back. 1 watt out, 1 watt coming back is an infinite standing wave ratio. You go to the right formula, that would tell you no loss. If correspondingly you sent 1 watt down and half a watt and a quarter of a watt came back, that would be a 6 dB loss both ways, and you know that the cable really has 3 dB of loss one way. Quarter watt versus 1 watt is a 6 dB difference, 6.02 to be exact. And so a pure short circuit or a pure open circuit at most HF frequencies, all the signal going down the cable cannot go any further. It's got to reflect back. And so a short or an open is a very handy way to test. Got to be a little bit careful when you get up to the super high VHF frequencies. The smallest connector we amateurs ever use is an SMA connector. An SMA connector is also called a 3-millimeter connector. A third of a centimeter is the outside diameter of the inner edge of the hardline cable. And the little SMA connector sticks out, about 3/32 of an inch. Very, very small. On one occasion, a buddy of mine was doing an experiment in his backyard in Smithtown, 10.2 miles from me, through the woods, in his backyard. He's doing an antenna measurement, and I'm sitting here in Huntington with my 2-foot dish on the top of the 100 feet of tower on 10 gigs, and I'm hearing his weak signal generator. He then disconnected the antenna. I had my receiver in the single sideband mode, and I still heard the tone in the noise. And I said, "Hey, Bruce, I'm still hearing your signal. Put your finger over the end of the cable." He did, and the signal disappeared. Take his finger away, I'm hearing it. In other words, the little 3/32 of an inch center conductor of a male 3-millimeter connector from 10 miles away, radiating a signal of, I think, about 10 milliwatts. I was hearing it from 10 miles away. Gives you some idea of what multipath can do. Back to you, Mel. K2IW on the segment.
Yeah, this is K2KEY, you know. I said from the time I was 4 years old when I first became realized what radio, you know, what it was about, has marveled me, and I'm really, I guess I gotta have that. That's why I have to have, I guess, like an addict, I have to have my RF, fix every day. But the reason I started out with using the Smith charts and similar ways of doing things initially, because of my day, and I'm going to date myself, we didn't have handheld calculators. We had slide rules. And many times with a slide rule, you could get easily confused. Oh, my God, did I put this, have to put zeros in this way or that way or what or where was the decimal point or whatever. So if I got it visually first, like on a Smith chart like this, then I know I can do the math, and I know approximately what my math answer is going to be. If I got some, you know, if I did it with the slide rule initially, I would say, gee, am I talking about 13 dBs or 1.3 dBs or 0.1, 0.13 dBs, you know? I would have possibly a little confusion there. And so with this, I know that where I'm going to really come out then mathematically. So I basically laid this out, you know, thinking that way. I know I'm sort of like my daughter says, a dinosaur. But I figured most people are using handheld antenna analyzers, like AEA or MFJ. And this way, you know, they could get a very good ballpark idea as to, you know, what feed line loss looks like, Dick, over.
Sure can. What's nice about cable calculations is that when you do it in decibels, the number of decibels per 100 feet or per foot tends to stay constant throughout the cable, even though the signal is getting weaker. If you did it in watts of calculation, life gets complicated. If I had cable that had 3 dB of loss per 100 feet, and I started off with 100 watts, after the first 100 feet, I would have 100 watts go down to 50 watt loss. In the next 100 feet, the 50 watts would go down to 25 watts of loss. In the next 100 feet, 25 watts would go down to 12.5. The mathematics is not quite as convenient. But in each one of those steps, each 100 feet would be exactly 3 dB, because you're always making a 2-to-1 ratio in power. And cable, under most circumstances, is a linear relationship, even though the real power is going down by an exponential relationship. It turns out an exponential equation of loss versus length, when plotted on semi-log paper, where one axis is logarithmic, it ends up as a straight line, the same number of dB per each equal length of cable. And you probably heard of one of my puzzles about what happens when you run waveguide to the moon. But I'll save that for another transmission. Back to you, Mel.
Exactly. This is K2KEY. So anyway, you know, just trying to really take the mystery out of a lot of this, as you call it, the jazz that we go through here. If you break it down, see the Smith charts actually, you know, is a... is not something that a lot of people thought of as impossible for non-engineers to use. It shows you that with these examples, just substituting, as a number of people said, they were able to substitute in. In fact, one took a test, said he did a problem, and showed the teacher how he did it. The teacher was impressed, which only leads me to think that I don't know that they teach any more use of the Smith chart in electrical engineering, or is it strictly CAD now, Dick, over?
I think it's half and half. For years and years, the tradition was the senior class in electrical engineering and wireless and radio techniques. They definitely taught you Smith chart and transmission line, and they mentioned the word antennas. And maybe it was a whole paragraph on a couple of the classes. Antennas are very lightly treated. Transmitters, a little bit better. Receivers, a little bit more than that. I'm a little bit worried, though, that modern-day schools probably go directly over to MathCAD or some other computer modeling program for figuring things out. And the good news is that you get answers a little bit faster with a few more decimal points, and in some cases you get some nice graphics. But these computer programs, if you're not careful, they can very easily become GIGO, G-I-G-O, which stands for garbage in equals garbage out. You make an error where the program wants you to give you length in meters and you use it in feet. The program might want you to give frequency in kilohertz and you get megahertz, or maybe it wants gigahertz. And maybe it wants the gain as a hard number and you've given it dB when it comes to an antenna, or insertion loss of the cable, or whatever. Some of these computer programs, although when you're used to the program, they give you beautiful answers in a hurry with nice graphics. But there's a couple of traps there in those programs. Some of them don't make it super clear exactly what units they want. Each one of the programs I write for wireless calculations in my handheld calculator, the very first line of the program will say, in this program, the equivalent of in this program, F equals megahertz, or F equals gigahertz, D equals feet, or D equals miles, D for distance, and so on. And each of my programs, I have to tell myself, because you're going to look at that program, if you've written it, and if it's got any real value, you're going to end up looking at it a month, 6 months, a year, 2 years later. Nobody's memory is that good, even though you wrote it. I don't know about you guys, but every so often I'll read a paragraph of a patent that I wrote or an article that I've written, and I'm reading it a year or two later, and I just find this piece of paper and I'm reading this paragraph, and I'll say, hey, this is pretty good stuff. Who wrote this? I won't recognize my own writing. I make a joke about that, and I say, yeah, that particular personality that was inside of the RIW head at 2 o'clock that morning when he wrote that, that personality right now is not there. And this looks like brand new material. So you got to document your programs. You got to document your notes. You got to say what the units were. What was the date? What did I measure? What was the significance? When you're writing an engineering notebook, you got to write down the units, the documentation. What did you saw? When did you see it? What did it mean? Because you'd be amazed how many times that notebook is going to become very valuable to you. I keep a daily logbook. I write a couple of sentences each day, what I did, who I talked to, what I saw, what happened. That has turned out to be extremely valuable on a couple of occasions, particularly when you thought what you did wasn't very significant. All of a sudden, 2 months later, you say, wow, that's an invention. We got a patent here. And you go back to that notebook, if it's properly documented, and if you really did it right, you had it signed by a witness, that on this particular day, we saw that happen. And that...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And that was the beginning of an invention. So in the real engineering world, and even in your own shop, in your own basement, for your own ham radio works, whether it's the logbook you're filling out, or for the contacts you've made, or the experiments you've done, or the antenna tests you did, there's a great advantage in documenting. Because at the time it happened, we all are optimistic. We say, hey, that was so significant, I would never forget this. 24 hours later, if you're a normal human being, you forget 50% of everything you've heard. In 1 week, you forget 90% of what you heard. Even though you said it, even though you did it, 1 week later, 90% of it's gone. But if you properly document it, it's there. And boy, there are times when that will be extremely valuable to you. For the few minutes it takes to write it down, once you set up a notebook and do that, you're gonna kiss yourself on both hands because you did that. K2KEY, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Exactly, this is K2KEY. I learned that a long time ago, teacher. That's one thing a teacher back in tech, Brooklyn Tech, actually told us. He says the best thing to carry is a little notebook in your pocket. And not only that, you make notes, he says. Anytime you meet somebody, they give you their name, they give you the company they work for, and I'll make a little description, in fact, so this way, next time you see them, you can look back in your little notebook and say, oh, hi there, Mr. So-and-so or Joe or whatever it was, he gave you the name, and how's so-and company ABC that you, how are things going there? And many times it impresses people, but I always, if I see something interesting, some kind of name on it, even on a piece of equipment, a can of some kind of even spray paint, maybe chemical that I think I may, need to use some day in the future for my own use, I see it at some other location, take a little note of it. And at home, yeah, I have a bunch of these, 8x11, the manila folders, and I put all my I slip in my my drawings and whatever it is in there and make very, very detailed notes. Anything that comes to my mind, I write in there, and every little snip of paper, and I try to make a little note as to why, where this, what its reference is. So Dick is very right. It's a good way for young people to learn, people out there that are listening. Keep a notepad, a daily notepad in your pocket, and you get home, you can transfer it to your files, or if you do any of your homework and everything, and someday you may want to refer it back, you may be working in the field, and you say, gee, I remember learning this in school, but I don't remember how the heck it was taught, what it was really completely about. If you have the detailed notes on it, you look back, it'll refresh your memory, because, let me tell you, real quick, what happened, especially a day later. That's good. Sometimes hours later. So Dick is 100% right. Keep notes. It's important. K2RIW and the TechNet, K2KEY.
Yeah, let me give you a couple of words about the opposite. In the engineering world, it doesn't take you very long to find an individual who develops the reputation that people give it a set of words. There's all kinds of synonyms for it, but the set of words that I've heard a lot is quick and dirty. There's a hell of a lot of engineers, maybe more of them than the complete ones. There's a hell of a lot of engineers who develop the reputation of being quick and dirty. He's a guy where you have trouble working with a computer program, and you call him over, and you watch him flip the keys a million miles an hour. He doesn't bother to tell you what he's doing. He just does it, and he says, there, and walks away. He's a guy that doesn't document anything. He's too busy getting it done in a super hurry and walking away to something else. And so it doesn't take very long before that guy gets an awful negative reputation. He doesn't get as many promotions. He doesn't get as many raises. The guy who's a little bit more meticulous, maybe even a lot more meticulous. Engineering is details. It's facts and figures. To an engineer, whether or not the standing wave ratio is 1.5 or 1.4 makes a big difference. If it was 1.5 today and it's 1.4 tomorrow at the exact same frequency, at the exact same power, that's telling you something. The fact that the VISWR went down, you'd say it's good. But your common sense tells you, Mother Nature doesn't do that. Water got in that cable, and the insertion loss of the cable went up. That's why the VISWR looks like it went down. Antennas don't cure themselves. They don't automatically move in exactly the right direction where the VISWR goes down. Mother Nature isn't like that. Just to put it, you've heard of Murphy's Law. If anything can possibly go wrong, it will. Well, engineer is quite often running to Elmer's Law. Elmer's Law states that Murphy was an optimist. The real world's a little worse. So, keeping records is almost always valuable. Rarely is that little bit of extra time. I mean, in an 8-hour work day, to keep good records may take you an extra 10 minutes. Is 10 minutes out of 8 hours worth the investment when a day, a week, a month, 6 months from now, that piece of information on that piece of paper that you wrote, that you properly documented, that's in a way that you understand it 6 months later, is that going to become valuable? You don't even have to ask that question. So you'll lead a more friendly life. You'll have a little bit more control of your environment. You won't feel like you're out of control. You won't feel like everything's coming out of the blue and hitting you in the back of the head and you didn't see it coming. You'll feel that you're in a little bit more control if you have the documentation. I'll give you another crazy example. In many of the companies where I've worked, once a week you have to fill out a time card. Some of the companies force you to do it every day. Some of them force you to do it at the end of the week. With that daily logbook, to write down what job number you worked on and how many hours you worked, to estimate, even if you didn't write down the exact number of hours for each individual job on each individual day. Because your notebook gives you a couple of sentences telling you what you did that day, you can easily make an estimate, well, I spent roughly half the day or a third of a day doing that function. And when you fill out your time card at the end of the week, it becomes simple. Huge advantage there. There's another advantage. There's been a number of weeks in which, because of the forgetfulness, at the time I'm pulling out the time card, I say to myself, boy, they didn't get their money's worth this week. I don't feel like I did very much. I intended to do such and such. I intended to do 1, 2, and 3. I really did a little bit of 3 and some of 4 and 5 that I never anticipated. I never did 1 and 2. And you can easily, at the end of the week, say, boy, I'm pretty useless. You can internally think that. And you start thinking pessimistic. You look at that notebook, and you start looking at all the stuff you worked on that week, and it suddenly all comes back to you because there it is in your own handwriting. And you completely forgot on Friday what you did on Monday and what you did on the second half of Tuesday. And when you see it all listed, you say, wow, they got their money's worth. And that's valuable, not only to them, but to you. It gives you the self-confidence that you're not a wasteful, useless human being. You've really done something. Documentation is good. K2KEY, K2LIW on the tech desk.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah. In fact, a number of places where I worked, they used to always say, you're gonna propose something, put it in writing and sign your name. That's it. In fact, one guy, that was his favorite. People come running over to him. And he'd say, put it in writing and sign your name. He wouldn't listen to you if you were walking in the hallway and he wanted to propose something. He just would shake his head. So no doubt that in this day and age, I know people are relying on all these different little electronic contraptions sitting in your pocket, all these electronic memo gadgets and all these things. But I don't know, I'm from the old school, Dick. I still carry the pencil and the little book in my pocket, and that's it. So I'm sure that, again, my daughter, of course, she was here. Dinosaur, dinosaur, dinosaur. That's it. Get with it in this age. But it's still, I think, the simplest way out. In many cases, the simple way out, like doing these type of problems first on a piece of paper with pencil and pen and a compass and a straight edge, I think is still the right way to go. I may be wrong, but that's my opinion. K2RIW in the TechNet, K2KEY.
What I do every day is I carry in my pocket a tiny little spiral ring notebook, which is about 3x5 size. And my guess is it's got about 50 pages. And it takes me a few months to fill one up. I got a date on the front cover, and then I go to the next one, put it in my pocket. In my pocket of my shirt, I carry a couple of 3x5 cards and a pocket protector for the pens and pencils. The pens and pencils are not on the outside of my pocket. I don't make it that obvious. I keep the whole thing, the pocket protector, the pens and pencils, the 3x5 cards, all of that's inside the upper pocket. But I carry that. And there are times when they both come in very handy. So that's my portable notebook. I have used electronic methods of storing things. And if you wait long enough, every one of them will fail you. The memory gets hung up, the battery goes dead, the data gets corrupted. I have yet to see an electronic storing method that I would trust for 2 or 3 solid years to hold on to my valuable information. There's an amazing number of people who will put everything into their cell phone, their checkbook pass numbers, their credit card numbers, and all kinds of things in there, and for favorite phone numbers and all kinds of information. And occasionally they lose it because something fails, or they completely forget about the fact that their cell phone has got all that jazz in it, all that information, and when the cell phone becomes obsolete and they buy another one, they give or throw away the old one. A smart person who knows how to dig into your cell phone can get all of that valuable information back out, even though you think you've erased it. With rare exception, it's still there. It's still there in some form of non-volatile memory by which people can find out your bank account numbers and whatever. There's been a couple of news reports about that lately where somebody found cell phones in the garbage can and started picking them out and realized that everything you wanted to know about that person, name and address and phone number of all their friends, banking account numbers and all kinds of and passwords for accounts on their computers and so on. Lots of valuable information. There's a lot of disadvantage. There's advantages in storing things like that electronically, as long as it's not vital information. But other than that, I would only trust things in writing where I know where the writing is. I've got more control of it. Although it's a dinosaur, and it's ancient and old-fashioned and bulky and whatever, it is a hell of a lot more reliable. That little notebook of mine, unless it falls into the sea and is floating around for a few hours, that is essentially a non-volatile memory. Whereas that electronic memory, there's only 10 ways it can fail on you. K2KEY, K2IW on the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, exactly. I carry the same exact thing in my pocket and been doing that for, oh my God, since a teenager, really. You know, you just brought up a very good point, Dick. I saw a news article on TV, a little spot, where one of these congressmen said that he's looking into these new RFID, you know, these swipe cards that you can, you know, rather than put it through, if you want to, you know, buy something, you just swipe it across this reader. And they showed a demonstration. They said that this person showed he can go into a crowd and just bump up against people, and while it's in their pocket, read the information there, all the information off of it, recording it, and go ahead and, of course, if he's dishonest, use it for purchasing things. But they have some kind of proposal, something's got to be done to control this. I didn't really, you know, get the gist of the whole thing, what they're trying to, the legislation that they're trying to put through. But I understand that this is going to be a problem with these RFID systems, Dick, how to protect them, over.
Yeah, I work with RFID every day, and there are staffs of people out there worried about personal security, worried about invasion of privacy, and so on. There are various proposals. The good news, because the RFID tag has got a lot more information than a barcode tag. A barcode has got something like 14 or 16 bits of information. An RFID tag, the run-of-the-mill ones have got 96 bits of information, and there are special ones that run into hundreds of bits. That gives you the ability to do some very elaborate encryption. And our encryption techniques that are very good. Nothing is perfect, but if you make it difficult enough, if there's encryption of the information that's in an RFID manner in your credit card. And if the encryption is good enough, it would take a good bank of computers and a smart guy months in order to break the code, in order to find out your information. And is he willing to make that investment in you when you're not a millionaire? Probably not. So there are definite privacy issues. I mean, right now the RFID tags are not cheap enough that you put them on every article of clothing. But that day is coming. RFID tags, if I had to pick a number out of the air, I would say they're 30 cents a piece. And if you're going to put it on a $5 shirt, that cuts heavily into the profit. The day will come when the RFID tag will be 3 cents a piece, and there'll be one buried in every shirt on the shelf. And as such, the store can very easily take an inventory because the shelf will have an antenna built into it which will read the tags, and you'll know exactly how many size 16 shirts are on the shelf and how many size 34 pants are on the shelf. You'll know that automatically. And when you take it off the shelf, the reader on the shelf will know that it was removed, know to reorder it. When you go to the checkout counter, they'll know exactly what it is real fast. You can walk straight through, so to speak, and it'll be credited to your particular credit card. That's the good news. The bad news is that if you're a person that stole the shirt and walked out of the store somehow without it being accounted for, but you didn't know there's a tag buried in the shirt, and at some later you come back into a store of that brand name, and they recognize it as a missing shirt because it's got that tag in it. There are people who think that, hey, you did something illegal, you should have been caught. There are other people who say that's an invasion of privacy, and should there be a kill command on the tag at the checkout counter? And so various stores were going to put tags on expensive clothing, and they decided to stop doing it because they were starting to get a lot of protests from the potential customers. So there's good and bads here. These tags are going to definitely help you trace material that goes through the total supply chain. So from the time it went from the manufacturer to the first truck that shipped it to a distribution center, to the next truck that shipped it to a warehouse, to the next truck that shipped it to the back of the store. If you've got RFID readers on each of those trucks and each of those distribution centers and warehouses, you know exactly where it was when. Particularly when it comes to things like the containers that come to the United States. 21,000 containers come by ship to our shores every day. 21,000 containers. Most of those containers have been at two or three other ports at overnight stays before it got to you. Lots and lots of opportunity for mischief to take place. With the right kind of RFID tags in the right places, you'll know whether or not the container was violated, whether or not it was opened, where it went, how long it went there, and so on. So properly used, these things are going to do magic. Your E-ZPass is a kind of RFID tag. It happens to have a battery in it, therefore it's called a semi-active RFID tag. Most of the RFID tags that are being manufactured today are thoroughly passive. You can, with the right kind of a reader, read that tag at 20 or 25 feet. There is no battery on board. The tag is good for the next couple of decades. Bring a reader within 25 feet of that tag, and it will spit out the 96-bit code. And the 96-bit code tells you everything you want to encode into that tag. That could be some extremely valuable information. When was it manufactured? Where was it manufactured? What lot number? Where did it go? How long it was there? Many of these tags, you can write to them as well as just read to them. So therefore, you can write various pieces of information to that tag as it goes to its various stops along that supply chain. You ain't seen nothing yet. Now, they've made some huge predictions as to how fast RFID is going to catch on. And it's catching on a little bit slower than that. Barcodes that are universal on every single item in every supermarket these days had a very similar beginning. Huge, wild enthusiasm at the beginning until they ironed the bugs out of the system. And now they're on absolutely everything. RFID tags are going to supplement barcodes, not replace them, supplement. Each has its advantage. There's nothing cheaper than a barcode. That's the good news. but you've got very limited information in it, and you have to visually see it to read it. Whereas an RFID tag could be on box number 14 that you lost a month ago in the warehouse because somebody put it on the wrong shelf, down the wrong aisle, and it's the third box back, and you can't even see it, and it's got perishable material inside. You take a reader that's in your hand, and you properly program it to look for tag 14, and you walk up and down the aisle, and pretty soon your reader in your hand beeps at you and says, "Hey, Mel, you just found box 14. It's on this aisle, it's to your right, and it's 4.5 feet away from you. Go get it." Is that valuable? Don't have to ask the question. K2KEY, K2RIW on the tech back.
Well, what I was really concerned about, this is Kate. The ones that you, I think we just backed into net mode. If we take these ones that, you know, you just pass over the reader in, that you can buy gasoline now with and all, is it possible that somebody can walk by you and read the information off it and do some, I could say, something illegal with it, use it illegally, just by, as they say, just by, you know, walking next to you with some kind of contraption in their pocket? Is that possible, Dick? And if so, is there a way that you can put it into some kind of, your card when not being used, put it in some kind of a shield to protect it over?
Yes and yes. I could show you a news report that was on Channel 2 News 3 months ago on that exact subject. And I could show you another program from the RFID Journal on that exact subject. Yes. With some of the low security type credit cards, you can walk past the person, press something almost against his clothing, never even touch him, and read it. And there are ways of encrypting it so what he reads is no good to him, and there are ways of putting it, into a metallic cover where it becomes almost impossible to read. So a smart person who knows he's got that kind of a tag can go to the right aftermarket place and buy one of these little metallic covers that you put the credit card into so that it cannot be read unless you bring it out of that cover. They're starting to do that with passports. Passports are now starting to have RFID tags in the cover, and those new passports with that capability come with a metal case that you put them into so that they can't be read until you, the owner, take it out of the case. Back to you, Mel.
Thank you. Question. If I took a piece of regular tin foil used for wrapping in the kitchen here and just folded it over my pocket and just dropped the card in there, would that be sufficient, over?
Okay, I think the answer is yes, but we've got to be careful now. What's called RFID, contactless reading, comes in 4 or 5 different frequency regions. There are some contact reading badges that run at 135 kilohertz. There's a whole slew of them that run at 13.56 megacycles. There's a zillion of them that run at 902 to 928 megacycles. There's a small number of them that run at 2.45 gigahertz, and a small number of them that run at 5.3 gigahertz. That tinfoil that you just described, it would certainly kill all the VHF ones. I think it would kill the 13.56, but you'd have to be careful. To be double darn sure, you would want all 5 edges of that tinfoil to be bound together to really kill the 13.56. The 125 kilohertz, maybe not. The 125 kilohertz is such a strong magnetic coupling that just a folded over piece of sheet metal of tinfoil might not do it. At 125 kilohertz, you calculate the skin depth of RF penetration, and it may be 10 times deeper than the thickness of your tinfoil. Back to you, Mel.
Right, and what material could you suggest? Something, instead of that, make a little, in other words, what can we put out on the market that would, say, would protect us overall? That's good. In other words, it has to be something to fit in the pocket that you can easily drop it into and easily take it out, you know, without going through any kind of unfolding or whatever, because that's the whole idea of it. You know, say we show advertisements, you know, guy running in with in a race and he's got to get a bottle of water and he's out of the store and just swipes it and he's back in the race again. You've seen that advertisement, I'm sure. Now, if you made it out of, I don't know, a little copper type of cover of some sort, you know, something like made out of copper and soldered up the edge, you know, actually make it so it's a nice little shield, would that be sufficient? In other words, what can be done? If something's got to, you know, be on the market fairly soon, because like you say, it is taking off slowly, but it's getting, you know, more prevalent. I see at the gas station, a lot of people come in on the self-service at the Amoco station, and I see them just passing this little thing that they have on there. In fact, they have them now that they're on their key ring with the car keys, Dick, over.
Yeah, the kind where they just press the card up against a window, that most likely is an RFID tag. The kind that they swipe through a slot is most likely a magnetic strip, which is different. Okay, when it comes to skin depth of penetration of low frequencies, you'll find out that copper is not good enough unless it's real thick and bound on all five or six sides. There is a material, it's called mu metal. Mu metal is a material that is very highly conductive to magnetic field. The 125 kilohertz tag is a 99% magnetic coupling. The tag is the secondary and your reader is the primary of the transformer that reads magnetically what's on that chip. So if you now make a little pocket, a five-sided thing with an opening on the sixth side where you slide it in, but it looks like tin foil, but it's a little thicker, but it's made out of this magic material called mu metal that will protect you. That's the good news. The bad news is the mu metal is quite a bit more expensive than tinfoil. The amount of mu metal required to do this, my guess is that we're talking about 50 cents or a dollar's worth of material. I, for one, would be willing to spend a dollar for the shield that I put over my credit card to make sure that nobody can inadvertently read it while it's in my wallet, in my pocket, as I'm in a crowd. So, rough guess, I think it's a dollar's worth of mu metal can do it, Mel. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Hey, question. Question, mu metal. Was that what was the shields were made out of that were used in the early color TVs? They used to have a metal shield around the picture tube. With a black, dull black metal. Was that mu metal by any chance, Dick, over?
Not sure, but it could have been. In the early days, I know they were very worried about Earth's magnetic field changing the convergence adjustment. In fact, in the early days, the sets were so sensitive that depending on whether you aimed the set to the north, the south, or the east, or the west in your living room, if you were a very critical watcher, it required a different convergence adjustment of the color set to get full performance. So under those conditions, was that metal mu metal? I think it could have been. I think there was a double motivation there. I think making it out of metal instead of glass made it a lot less pounds, made it a lot less dangerous if it got crushed. Instead of shattering gas, it just became a crumpled up chunk of metal. So there's a lot of motivations for making it metal. Was it mu metal? Could have been. The only thing that's stopping me from thinking that is, in those days, that amount of mu metal would have been pretty darn expensive. So I ain't sure. Thank you, Mel.
Talking about, no, it wasn't the picture tube made out of the metal. It was the shield that slipped in over it. You know, you mounted the shield over it and folded up and was held usually with a big number of, when it folded together, you put a clamp, like a screw, to pull it all together. In other words, when you wanted to change the picture tube, you opened up this shield that unfolded, literally. It was four pieces. And you slipped the tube out from between it. And And I could say it just opened up like a big clover leaf. I don't know if you remember that in the color TVs of the 70s, you know, and the 80s, on the rectangular picture tubes when it came out with it. It was a thin metal. I mean, it was, oh, I guess...